Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, greetings to everyone along Florida's Space Coast, and especially to those of you who are listening live online at WMMBAM.com. This is Space Talk for August 22nd, 2009, and I am Jim Behnke, your host for the next hour, as we get you up to date on some of the things that are happening with our nation's space program. And on today's program, we'll briefly preview the upcoming mission of Space Shuttle Discovery and share with you the latest from the Kennedy Space Center on the countdown to launch. That liftoff now set for 1:36 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, very early Tuesday morning, basically Monday night after the late shows. Stay tuned for the launch at 1:36 in the morning on Tuesday. Mostly today, though, we're going to spend our time talking together about the a very interesting experiment that NASA flew this past Monday from the Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia on the Virginia shore. I had the pleasure of spending most of my week this past week up in Virginia and was on hand for that launch, toured Langley Research Center and went to Kitty Hawk this week. It was a great, great week of aeronautics activities, more than space. But in any case, this mission that they flew from Wallops was called IRVI for short, and we'll get into it more later in the program. Was just a spectacular, quick little flight, about a 20-minute mission, and some very interesting potential for future space exploration. I want to share that with you today. We'll have some folks on that were responsible for that test a little bit later in the program. Of course, throughout today's program, if you would like to join in on the conversation and be a part of Space Talk, you're certainly welcome to call here into the studio live right now, 768-1240. If you're an AT&T wireless customer here in Brevard County, just dial *1240 on your cell phone. That'll get you right in here. That's a free phone call. And if you are listening to us online at WMMBAM.com from anywhere in the nation or the world, give us a call at 321-768-1240 or just open up the screen and send us email right now to spacetalking@AOL.com, and you can be a part of the program. Send us some questions that way if you want. Well, look, you know, when it comes to our space news here in Central Florida, you know, we tend to focus on what's happening here at the Cape, and even then, that news tends to be very heavy on NASA and how NASA affects Florida, and that's rightly so. But there is so much going on in our space program around the nation and around the world on any given week. So much more than what's happening in our backyard. And this past week, by the way, we'll get this out of the way, in which, by the way, Brett Favre finally signed with the Minnesota Vikings. And although he had a slow start last night with Kansas City, we still have our hopes for this season. But I digress. Space news during the past week has really come from all over the place. And it's very typical of the kind of busy week there is each week in space. You just don't always necessarily hear about everything that's going on. And so for the next couple of minutes, let me share with you some of the things that have happened this week in the space programs around the world. Let's start with Friday night. Friday night in South America at the Guyana Space Center in Kourou, French Guyana, two communication satellites that were actually built in the United States, but for Asian and Australian satellite operators, were launched together on an Ariane 5 rocket. The Ariane is the European Space Community's commercial rocket, launches again from South America, very close to the equator, and obviously a big competitor to the United States and to other nations providing launch services. And really, over the years, has carried the bulk of the commercial work that that goes on. And Friday's launch of the Ariane 5, which is just their huge workhorse booster, I guess was the fourth of seven planned launches for the Ariane 5. In 2009, officials were celebrating the fact that this was the 32nd success in a row for Ariane 5, which had a slow start, but really has picked up and is really quite the force to be reckoned with in terms of the commercial space world. Another part of the world, on Wednesday, South Korea attempted to launch its first rocket into space. They've done some missile testing through the years. Certainly, we've been watching North Korea and their missile testing. But in the case of South Korea, they wanted to launch and become a part of the space program fraternity, the orbital fraternity, and have the Korean Space Launch Vehicle 1 rocket set to go. Came within about 8 minutes of launch on Wednesday, and apparently, as reported now, a software glitch shut everything down. This two-stage rocket has a Russian first stage that the Koreans basically just bought from Russia. Russia's providing services and advice and operations and all that, and a Korean-developed second stage. So the problem was in the first stage, and they're trying to work through that. No new launch date set yet, but again, showing you how there is so much more going on than just here at the Cape. Launches in South America, an attempted launch Wednesday in South Korea. Also on Wednesday, just in terms of historical note, another one of the original Werner von Braun team members died in Huntsville. Walter Jacoby. An original member of Dr. Werner von Braun's rocket team that came to the America after World War II, died. He was 91. This man was responsible for some of the component work inside the Saturn V moon rocket in terms of the fuels and liquid propellants, the liquid oxygen, the kerosene, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, some of the upper stages, some of the big valves that needed to be moved and to move that propellant around. He was responsible for designing and operating and troubleshooting. And so, again, another great rocket pioneer. Now, we don't normally hear about these guys here in Florida, but in Huntsville, the German rocket team is still legendary. And apparently right now, according to the Huntsville news media, one, two, three, four, about four more of the original 118 German rocket scientists are still around here in Huntsville. Tuesday, speaking of space news, at Mars. Now we're going to another planet here for our space news. The Mars rover Spirit has now been operating as of Tuesday for 2,000 Martian days. Spirit's twin Opportunity is going to hit the 2,000 Martian day milestone on September 8th of this year. These two rovers, if you recall, were launched and sent to Mars with the hopes that maybe they would last 90 days on Mars, and here now still going after 2,000 Martian days. JPL put together some notes here. I guess, let's see, since they landed in January of 2004, Spirit has driven 4.8 miles around the Martian surface and Opportunity 10.7 miles around the Martian surface. So, incredible stuff that they've sent back 246,000 images of Mars since landing there. And in case you're wondering how long is a Martian day, it is about 40 minutes longer than an Earth day. So 2,000 Martian days for Spirit and 2,000 Martian days for Opportunity coming up here on September 8th. Going back to Monday, of course, yes, stuff does happen here at the Cape. Monday morning, a beautiful launch of the Delta II rocket from Cape Canaveral. I understand it was one of the most spectacular launches in the history of the Delta program, coming right at sunrise at about 6:35 in the morning. It launches in the dark and catches the sun as it climbs up out of the atmosphere. I apologize for not being here to bring you coverage of that event. I was up in Virginia for this other launch that we'll talk about here after the break. But an important milestone in the history of this program, as the final Global Positioning System satellite was flown on the Delta II. Now, the Delta II still has a few more launches left. This will be its last Air Force mission. We'll see a few more launches from the Cape here over the next couple of years, and then they'll get ready to shut down that program unless something comes along and says we need some more of them and someone's willing to buy them. But in any case, 48 to 49 Delta II GPS missions successful. I remember February 14th, Valentine's Day, 1989 was the first one, and I was on hand for that. So the other thing that happened Monday morning was this Irby launch from the Wallops Flight Facility, and we want to talk about that, the inflatable reentry vehicle experiment. We'll talk about that after this break. We'll have a couple of guests, and we hope to have you join us here on Space Talk with Jim Banky. Stay tuned. It's going to be a good show for the rest of the hour. Stand by.
During these troubled economic times, you may have questions about your financial future. The experts at FPT Services in Rockledge have the answers. They'll listen to you, develop a custom plan, and work as your partner with a full array of financial and estate planning services. Don't wait for the economy to recover. Call FPT Services in Rockledge at 631-0383. That's 631-0383. Find them online at fptservices.com.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, good afternoon again, everybody. Welcome back to Space Talk. I am Jim Behnke, and reminding you that you can call us at 321-768-1240 or star 1240 for your local AT&T wireless customers. Be sure, by the way, to visit WMMBAM.com. Well, not only can you listen to this live broadcast right now, but if you also enter the keyword Space Talk, you'll see our new show webpage. And if you can do that right now, you will see some pictures and links to information about the topic of the day today, which is NASA's Inflatable Reentry Vehicle Experiment, which sounds very scary, so we'll just call it IRVE for the rest of the show. Okay, so now here's the deal. Let's say you want to drop a probe onto the surface of Mars, but to get where you want to go on the surface of Mars, you have to rely on a heat shield that is bigger in diameter than the nose cone of the rocket that your probe had to travel to Mars to get to. So now you need a heat shield bigger than the rocket. What is the answer? Well, two folks who can help us find out about that and talk about this IRVE mission, which is the answer, by the way, are with me today. Mary Beth Lusk is the program manager for IRVE, once again, the Inflatable Reentry Vehicle Experiment. And Stephen Hughes is the lead engineer for the reentry vehicle itself. Both are based at NASA's Langley Research Center, where, coincidentally, both have worked since 1989. Langley's up in Virginia, used to be known and still is as the Mother Center. All of our spaceflight stuff came originally with the Space Task Group at Langley, a very historic site up there in Hampton, Virginia. Now, Mary Beth is phoning us in from her home in Yorktown, Virginia. And Steve should be talking to us, I guess, from his home in Hampton, Virginia. And Mary Beth and Steve, welcome to Space Talk.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Good. Mary Beth, everything going okay so far?
So far, so good. We do have a severe storm here, so we've lost power a few times. So hopefully I'll hang on to the line for a little while.
Nothing. Oh, yeah, I guess there was some stuff rolling through, wasn't there? Okay, we'll see what happens. Well, let's talk really quick then. First of all, Mary Beth, as the program manager, thank you, by the way, for your hospitality and that of your team and some of the PAO folks, Kathy Barnsdorf, Keith Kohler at Wallops, Elaine Goss for doing a lot of the travel logistics. I had a great time being up there for the launch and helping me get around up there. That was great, so thank you very much.
Absolutely. We're glad you could come.
It was good, wasn't it? Steve, let's talk about the vehicle. Let's get into it. Now, as I understand the story about how this whole thing came about, it might have had something originally to do with a plan by NASA to fly a Mars sample return mission, go up to Mars, get a sample, bring it back to Earth. Is that kind of where it was, or tell me more about that?
I was working Earth entry vehicle concept that was part of the Mars sample return mission that was being put together in 1999, and we were working difficult problem getting the components onto the Martian surface, and they needed a whole lot more mass capability to get to the surface. And at that time, we weren't proposing an inflatable heat shield. We just realized there was a big problem with getting the amount of mass we needed to the surface with the heat shields that we had available to us at the time. I actually ended up working Mars Science Laboratory, which was MSL, which I believe is supposed to launch next year now, for advanced heat shield concepts. We were looking at carbon-carbon heat shields and other hot structure heat shields so that we could get the heat shield a lot hotter, so we could dive deeper in the atmosphere and slow down. It's kind of odd to think of. You dive deeper in the atmosphere, but you slow down faster. So
right.
You end up with more timeline on your entry, descent, and landing timeline. So, again, we're still struggling with the problem of getting the payload slowed down fast enough and then having enough time left to do all the things you need to do to touch down to the planet without impacting the planet's surface.
Well, let me see if I can break that down a little bit. So with Mars having a relatively thin atmosphere, certainly compared to Earth, and correct me when I goof this up, because Mars's atmosphere is so thin, its denser parts of the atmosphere is closer to the surface. And Mars, generally speaking, has sort of a lower sea level, lower elevation on the northern side, and a little higher elevations, mountains and that kind of thing on the southern hemisphere. And if we want to be able to land a probe on, let's say, the higher elevations, the mountainous areas on the southern hemisphere, you have to basically enter Martian atmosphere and slow down higher and faster so that you can get safely to those higher elevations. Is that where we're headed with this?
That is correct. You need to figure out some way to slow down higher so you can do all the things you need to do before you touch down on the planet's surface.
Whether that's inflating a bag or dropping a parachute or firing retro rockets or whatever it is.
That's correct.
Okay, so since you're limited by the size of the nose cone or the fairing of the rocket, then when did it become obvious to you or apparent to you that maybe an inflatable heat shield was the answer?
I was working MSL, actually, after we had the two disappointing failures for Mars Climate Orbiter and Mars Polar Lander. The whole Mars program kind of slowed down at that point. I switched jobs because Mars Sample Return stopped for a while they reevaluated the program. And we were still having difficulty trying to figure out how to get to more landing sites on the planet. And I actually thought about deploying something similar to an umbrella. But someone else at the center was working on that problem, looking at that problem, so I didn't pursue that any further.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have an opportunity to sit in on a review of a proposal that was being presented at JSC for an inflatable aeroshell that the Russians had done. And they had actually built an inflatable aeroshell in 1996, or for the 1996 Mars mission that they were running.
Right.
Unfortunately, they had a vehicle failure and didn't get the probe delivered to the planet, so they never had a chance to test the technology.
Okay.
But they were also continuing that technology in cooperation with ESA Austrian, obviously a European space group, and they were trying to market this technology. And they had done inflatable reentry decelerator test, which is another inflatable cone that was going to enter the atmosphere and slow down.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in their view, and I thought, well, this is a great way to get more area, which is exactly what we needed to do so we could slow down higher. But I saw some things in their program that or in their design that I thought were dangerous, things that we should be avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, they have their outer fabric is doped with a material that ablates during entry, so
okay.
That they boil off material and cool off the surface with that. The problem with that approach, though, is if you run out of ablator, your system fails. So you have to carry a lot of extra ablator to...
You don't want the inflatable structure to burn through and pop a hole, and then you lose the whole structure.
That's correct. So you have to carry a lot of margin, a lot of extra material, just to make sure that in any off-nominal case, you don't end up using up all your ablator. So my thought is, well, why not use some of these advanced materials we have to date and just absorb the heat or insulate against the heat? And I did some research and found some material combinations and started writing some proposals to try and get some research dollars to study this problem, and eventually we ended up with Irby.
Now, people think of heat shields right now. I mean, the average person knows about, for example, an Apollo heat shield, which is that ablative material that it burns off and it takes the heat away. We've got the shuttle with the heat protection tiles, which is just sand and a lot of air, basically, now, but very fragile. An inflatable device, I mean... What kind of fabric are we talking about that can withstand such tremendous heat?
There are many ceramic fabrics out there. One we're using on Irby is a Nextel 312 fabric. It's a word that nobody will understand, aluminum borosilicate, but it's just a ceramic fabric that can take that very high heat. The problem, in addition to that, is you have to insulate that inflatable.
Okay.
There are lots of other insulating materials out there that you can look at. But what I looked at mostly was furnace insulating. As flexible materials that are durable enough to, and can take that high heat on one side and knock that temperature down through the thickness.
Well, and is it true that the larger heat shield can slow down faster, slower, doesn't generate as much heat? Or
The bigger you make it, the quicker it slows down, and the lower the peak heat rate that's applied to the air.
So you can use these kind of materials that are less susceptible to the damage. We're coming up here on our bottom of the hour break. Mary Beth, when we come back, I want to talk about sort of Langley's role in this, the fact that this whole thing comes from the aeronautics side, this test came from the aeronautics side of NASA, as opposed to what you would think would be a space mission. And I think some of that's fascinating to share with the people. So we're going to talk to you about that in just a minute. In the meantime, we want to remind everyone that if you do have any questions about this topic, or really anything having to do with the space program at this point, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 768-1240, star 1240 on your AT&T wireless customer telephone. And send us email at spacetalking@AOL.com, and we'll take a look at that right now and see what you have to say. So stand by for this bottom of the hour break, news, weather updates, and we'll be back in just a few minutes on Space Talk here on WMMB.
It's an Endeavor roll program.
Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course.
OTCS Go.
A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Bye, let's go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston Flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy, undergo skill assessments, take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready.
PTC, go.
Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post-shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the second half of Space Talk. And we're talking about the inflatable reentry vehicle experiment that NASA flew from the Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia this past Monday. And on the line with us is Mary Beth Wusk, the program manager for the experiment, and Stephen Hughes, who was the lead reentry vehicle engineer for this experiment. And Mary Beth, are you still with us?
I am.
I see. I'm checking the radar. I see that the red squall line is about to go through Hampton right now.
Yeah, I think it's here.
I think it's there. If you need to get out the phone, let me know, and we want you to be safe, so just let me know. Talk real quickly, if you would, about Langley's role and kind of on the management side. How did this project come together, and why is this based at Langley as opposed to, say, Kennedy or the Johnson Space Center or even JPL?
Well, the project was formalized, I guess it was about August of 2008, and initially we had launched the first Irby back in September of 2007. And due to a vehicle deployment failure, we did not have success on that mission. So the ARMD, the Aeronautics Research Division for Langley, for headquarters, they recognized the importance of entry, set, and landing vehicles and this technology. And so they asked us to do a rebuild since the team had worked it for about 4 years, 4 or 5 years at Langley. On the first Irby, they brought it back to us again, and we teamed with Wallops to provide us the launch vehicle and the launch operations, the range operations on the Eastern Shore. And so the idea was rebuild the same air shell and the same reentry vehicle, and launches successfully. So that's kind of how this initiated. And so for this mission, we started pretty much, I think, it was about 15 months from when we purchased the first pieces of hardware to when we launched, which is a fairly quick turnaround for a mission.
Yeah, like really.
It's a very small team. We had about 10 civil servants and probably about 10 to 15 people as off-site, as well as the ILC contractors and the Wallops range support, which was a combination of civil servants and contractors under Northrop Grumman.
And ILC meaning the company ILC Dover that fabricated the heat shield itself, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So team worked together on a fairly tight schedule, very optimistic schedule, but we had to complete the series of ground tests that we had done previously. And the concept is we had to make sure we didn't fail. So we did everything we could on the ground to reduce any risk that we were carrying, to ensure that we were satisfied that design was good to go. And we extended the testing a little, even a little more extensively than they did on the first Irby, just to ensure that we wouldn't have any issues when we launched. So things went well on last Monday, and I know the team was quite relieved. We had representatives from ILC. We had the entire team from Langley out there, and I guess you were at the island?
I was at the visitor center.
At the visitor center. Okay.
Yeah. Watched it all on TV. You know, it's the same kind of thing down here at Kennedy. You know, the shuttle's going off in our backyard, but I can't even take myself to go outside and watch it. I have to watch it on television, make sure I'm hearing everything, seeing everything. So I was getting a little teased at the visitor center that I travel all the way up to Virginia and watch this thing, you know, on the TV. But
yeah, it's a trade to be out at the island to feel it and see it versus seeing the data coming back, you know, through the telemetry, so you have a little more assessment of how it's doing once we launch.
And there's probably not as many mosquitoes in the control center as there is out on the island.
Well, I did hear that the Wallops personnel were very disappointed that you guys, that the team of people that were out at the island weren't out there longer to do their annual blood drive.
Yeah, they were able to sneak out right at the last second. So, well, in fact, that was one of the funny things that I noticed. I found I'd never been to Wallops in the Eastern Shore, and I just found the whole place very charming and a lot of fun to visit. I can understand why it appeals to so many people. But I got a big kick out of the idea of, okay, I'm going to compare this to the Kennedy Space Center. So we're this giant spaceport down here. Wallops is relatively small. We both have the problem with mosquitoes. And, of course, just to the north of Kennedy, actually still on Kennedy property, is Mosquito Lagoon. And then I noticed that as I was crossing the bridge from Chicoutimi, from the hotel to the visitor center, I was crossing Mosquito Creek.
Yes.
So I thought that was all very somehow it worked for me, and it was the one story I keep telling, and now I've told you that story. So, well, the thing about aeronautics, let's go back to the aeronautics question, because the thing that fascinates me about in working on NASA's aeronautics side and helping the way I do in my other jobs is that NASA Aeronautics is responsible for hypersonic flight through the atmosphere. And that's certainly what this experiment involved, right? Flying through hypersonic speeds. The thing I get is fascinating to me about this is that your mission is to study hypersonic flight through an atmosphere, but it doesn't matter what planet you're on. So whether it's Mars or Earth or somewhere else, once you're in the air, it's the NASA Aeronautics side of the house that has to go look at all that. So what's in store? I mean, now what do you do with all this? You're crunching data now. Can you talk a little bit about what's left to do there, and then what's next for Irby and Steve? Do you have other vehicles on the drawing board?
Yep, we are going through our data. We had our first assessment, the quick look data, and the video was a strong indicator that everything performed as expected. What you weren't seeing that we were seeing in the control room is a variety of data channels that we're monitoring to make sure the pressures were going to the values we expected, the temperatures were maintaining, that the instruments were still responding to us. So we have a good indication that the vehicle did respond as we expected, and obviously the video showing that it stayed inflated all the way down to about 9,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
As far as and I'll have Steve, if you want to add any more on that, you can.
No, the vehicle performed excellently. And as far as aerodynamics and aerodynamic stability, it was a great test. We saw our initial what we were trying to test was hypersonic down to peak pressure or the peak acceleration on the vehicle for this mission. But we
had yeah, Steve, you're really breaking up there. I'm sorry, Mary Beth. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
So we're looking at peak pressures and you know the heat flux and through the reentry phase. So we're looking from 80 down to 40,000 feet. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we heard the pop, but that's okay.
Okay. I still have my lights on, so that's good here. So the vehicle ended up staying inflated all the way down to 9,000 feet, so we definitely exceeded our expectations on the performance of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, what we're trying to do is compare what our analysis show, you know, that we all of our modeling that we did pre-launch, and then compare with the flight test. This was a technology demonstration. And it's, you know, it's not something you can test on the ground. We did as much testing as we can in vacuum chambers and, you know, doing the deployment test, you know, to make sure that functionally everything would work well. But we don't have our relevant environment.
Yeah. I like the phrase wind tunnel in the sky that Neil Cheat would use.
Yeah, that was from Jay Scott, I believe.
Oh,
so
Jay Scott?
It's taken our testing to the next level. So the concept, if we want to enter the Mars atmosphere, is we need to get a more realistic, relevant environment.
Mm-hmm.
So our next steps, you know, and right now they are looking at conceptually IRVI 3, and
mm-hmm.
I think that they're going to go through the assessment and at least they're through preliminary design review and look at how they can achieve higher heat rates for a more relevant environment. So a little bit larger sounding rocket, but still a sounding rocket, which definitely a plus for us because they're very inexpensive compared to larger launch vehicles. And similar shape, you know, the diameter of the air shell will stay about 3 meters, but we're gonna be looking at heat rates. I think we were looking for IRVI 2 to be 2 watts per centimeter squared, and we're looking at going about 10 to 15, I think, watts per centimeter squared.
What's that in more relative terms? Is that hot as a hot sidewalk, shuttle reentry, surface of the sun?
It's like an oxyacetylene torch.
Wow, so that's pretty darn hot.
Yeah.
Now, Steve, it sounds like we got a good signal from you. Talk about the fact that this was a scale model, I guess, in the sense that it was, you know, like Mary Beth said, about 3 meter wide, 10 foot wide. Diameter heat shield. Eventually, what can you just take this and just scale it up as big as you want? Is there some limitations there?
As far as we've seen so far with some mock-ups, we don't see any difficulty scaling up, and we're figuring for a Mars robotic mission, we'd probably be looking at about a 12-meter air shell by the time we're done.
Now, those of us who have just enough engineering in our reading, in our background, to really mess things up, because we base everything on what we see on TV and movies, you know, we look at the movie 2010, which has got this great shot of the Russian ship and this big giant balut aerobraking, you know, using the atmosphere of Jupiter to break into orbit. This is what? I mean, comparing to that, really, that's fiction, but not so dissimilar. An inflatable heat shield that you pop open, you burn through the atmosphere, you deflate, deploy, release, and can it be used for that same kind of a purpose as well?
That's exactly what we're planning on using it for. They're doing system studies for these human missions to Mars right now. And the inflatable air shell is performing very well compared to a rigid air shell. I think it's called an ellipse sled, or where you're doing what you can with a rigid air shell that you don't have to deploy.
Wow.
The masses, you're about 25% mass savings for the inflatable air shell concept.
Okay. So that's Mary Beth, one last quick question for you, and then we're going to let you guys go. If you fly again, when next, do you think? Another year and a half, 2 years?
24 to 30 months.
I think it was about 18 months from if we get approval to go.
Okay, good.
Is that correct, Steve?
Mary Beth, Steve, got to let you go. Thank you so much for being on. Get safe. Watch out for those storms. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. Be back. Update everyone on Discovery's launch here this week.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Well, as we wrap up this edition of Space Talk, I want to spend a few moments here at the close of the program and looking ahead to the launch of Shuttle Discovery early Tuesday morning here from the Kennedy Space Center and give you an update. Let's let you know, first of all, that the countdown did begin last night at 11 o'clock Friday night, aiming again for the 1:36 a.m. launch on Tuesday morning. Everything going well with the countdown so far. Basically, early activities in the countdown involve cleaning up the pad, moving off some equipment, work platforms, shutting panels, and closing everything out for flight. Later, they'll start loading the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen reactants that are stored inside tanks inside Discovery's mid-body. Those are the particular chemicals that are used to be combined in fuel cells and generate electricity for the mission, not to be confused with the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen that is loaded into the external tank beginning about 12 hours or so before launch. And, of course, that'll begin sometime Monday, late Monday afternoon, early Monday evening. So far, the weather looking pretty good for a launch Tuesday morning during the short 5-minute launch window. Again, the mission to the International Space Station having this, that very short time that they can get off the ground. The weather percent 70% go, which is pretty encouraging. And given that it's in the middle of the night, whatever nastiness happens during the day is usually cleared up by then and not so much a worry. And given where all the kind of lows and highs are over the state and over the Atlantic Ocean right now, it's looking pretty good that Tuesday morning weather won't be a concern. The only concern they're really looking at for weather is during the beginning of tanking, again happening late in the day about supper time on Monday. Any residual thunderstorms that are still out there. In fact, some of the stuff that we're seeing blowing through right now, a little squall looking like it's over parts of Brevard here now and over Merritt Island. Looks like there's a special marine warning out over the water over the Atlantic right now. That's moving through pretty quick. But again, it's the exact kind of thing they're thinking about might happen on Monday, in which case they might have to wait an hour or two to begin tanking. But they've got a lot of padding there to allow that to happen. This mission to the International Space Station basically was a resupply mission. They're carrying the Italian-built Leonardo Multipurpose Logistics Module, the MPLM, which is a fancy mouthful of saying a big giant suitcase, a moving van, a cargo container. They'll carry that up in the cargo bay. The robot arm will pluck it out of the Discovery's cargo bay, attach it to an open port on the space station. They throw open the doors, and then it's just a wild group of activity. Choreographed, I might say, very well. They've really gotten it down to a science, taking everything out, putting it where it needs to be, and then stuffing this thing back full of stuff that needs to come back to Earth, not only garbage, but also experiment results and broken parts and spare supplies and all that. 7-member crew going up on this flight, including Nicole Stott, who was going to stay up on the space station until November. By the way, she happens to be an Embry-Riddle graduate and in fact, graduated the same year in the same class that I did in 1987 up in Daytona Beach. We're trying to figure out if she and I have ever met or whether we crossed paths. I was a business major. She was an engineering major, and engineers didn't have much of a social life at school, but they got better grades, and she's flying to the space station, and I'm not. So take that for what it's worth. But the 7 astronauts going up, she's going up. Tim Kopra coming back. He just went up on the station in July, so he gets a little short visit there as that 6-member space station crew does its thing up in orbit. During this flight, again, the main deal, delivering her and delivering the Leonardo cargo module to load it and unload it, one of the interesting things that's going to get a lot of attention during this flight is the fact that the famous Colbert treadmill is going up on this flight. The Colbert treadmill, that is an acronym for, listen to this now and take a deep breath, the Combined Operational Load-Bearing External Resistance Treadmill. Or Colbert, named for the comedian Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's The Colbert Report. You'll recall that NASA had a Name the Node contest, its last node, and Colbert got a hold of it, said, write my name in, and thousands of people did that, and wound up he being the winning name. NASA left in an interesting situation. Do they name a module on the space station after this comedian? And, of course, no, they don't, but NASA does have a good sense of humor. They really do. These guys of public affairs and the program office at headquarters figured out the perfect response to this. They're going to name the mode Tranquility, but they said, well, you know, we're going to have this treadmill in there. Let's give it a name. They gave it a name. They've already designed a patch for it, and Colbert gets to fly into space as the treadmill. So the astronauts will be running on the Colbert, and you can be sure that that he'll be mentioning that this week on his late-night shows. So that's one of the interesting things going up. The more important stuff, of course, having to do with spacewalks. There are three spacewalks planned for this flight. And they're pretty much going to be swapping out some hardware, an empty ammonia tank for a full one. They're going to make some connections on the space station to help with the further assembly. And they're also going to install a rack outside the space station that's going to allow future shuttle missions to hang spare parts on the vehicle. As, again, the shuttle missions start winding down here, the opportunity to carry some big pieces of hardware up to the station as spares is greatly becoming limited. So they're going to pack that thing as absolutely full as they can with all the different kind of hardware, spare parts, orbital replacement units that they can, and find stuff inside the station. And, again, as we see, they're going to hang stuff outside the station as well so that, that we can survive as long as possible without the need for shuttle and relying on some of the other smaller vehicles to carry up the supplies that are needed. So Rick Sturko is the commander of this flight going up, and veteran of three space flights already. He's commanding the seven-member crew. We'll talk more about that as we do our coverage here later in the week. Now, the plan right now for our coverage on WMMB of the launch is for me to go on the air at about 1:15 on Tuesday morning and bring you that live coverage of the countdown and launch through the time when I'm on the air to the time when it launches or scrubs or arrives in orbit, whatever happens to happen. We invite you to stay tuned during the evening to Fox News coverage of updates of the countdown. I will also post some updates every once in a while on the Space Talk page on the WMMB website. So tune into WMMBAM.com. Use keywords Space Talk, and you'll get to that page, and we'll post a few updates to let you know maybe before it's worth taking a nap or going to bed or whatever, what's happening there. And again, we'll come on the air at 1:15 to bring you coverage of the launch. Next week on Space Talk, we're going to turn our attention towards space education, especially the idea of inspiring kids to pursue careers in spaceflight by the use of model rockets. And I'm going to have a couple of my Embry-Riddle buddies on. Patrick McCarthy from Space Florida and my old buddy Wes Olszewski. We'll talk about him next week, and he'll be here for that as well. So stay tuned to all that. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week with more Space Talk and with you Tuesday morning for coverage of Shuttle Discovery. Take care and have a great weekend. Bye for now.